and welcome to the Data Protection Made Easy podcast with me, Ollie Rear. I'm joined here for this intro by Miles. Afternoon, Miles.
Afternoon, Ollie. How are you?
Yeah, I'm all right, mate. I'm all right. It was a good podcast today. Good session. We talked about re-engaging with lapsed donors for those in the charity sector. We were joined by Zam Asif from No Checks, our partners. He had some really great insights, particularly on working with a lottery provider and a payment platform provider. So it was absolutely fantastic to have him on. But loads of good interaction as always this week, wasn't there?
Yeah, great bit of interaction from everybody. Lots of people getting involved in the chat and lots of people unmuting and getting involved as well, which is great.
That's what we like. Even though it was perhaps a little bit more relaxed than we'd normally do on one of these structured sessions. So anyway, we hope you enjoyed this. We hope the pre-recorded intros are going down well. We didn't get any feedback on the last one. So if you do have any thoughts on it, please do get in touch. You know, we're always looking to improve this product. It's something we've worked hard on and we're very proud of. So, you know, if you've got any feedback at all for us on that front, whether you like this, whether you don't, then do let us know. And we're working continuously to try and improve it. If you want to get in touch with Zam in particular off the back of today's session, just reach out to us and we'll put you in contact with him. He's got loads of really valuable insights on this sort of thing, and it was great to have him on, so thank you to him once again. And we hope you enjoy the episode. Any thoughts before we kick off, Miles?
No, let's get started, Ollie.
All right, let's get started. Well, in that case, I will leave you in the very capable hands of David Holmes, Zam Asif, and myself. So before we get stuck into our main topic for today, we'd like to do a little bit of what's been in the news. But before that, Zam, could you introduce yourself for us, a little bit about yourself, you guys at No Checks, and what you do over there?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. Hi, everyone. So my name is Zam. So basically, I have been working for No Checks since 2018. So we are an online payment provider. And what we do is we help companies, organizations, charities, anyone with an online presence who wants to take online payments, very similar to PayPal. So if you want to take payments online, that's what we do. So we support various charities across the UK to take donations online. The company No Checks, we've been going for over 20 years now. And from the beginning, you know, we've always been doing a lot of work with charities. And it's only in the last, I'd say, in the last two, three years, certain campaigns have occurred, which I can talk about in more detail at a later stage. We've done a lot of different campaigns for different charities, whether it be fundraising campaigns, whether it be donation pages for charities. So we've done a lot of work since then. But yeah, I could talk about that in more detail if you like, Oliver, at a later stage, or if you want me to talk about it now.
We'll get to that very shortly, but the key point being that plenty of wonderful experience for us to lean on, so we thought it'd be valuable to have you on. So thank you for coming on and chatting with us. So just quickly before we get stuck into the main topic, as I said, a little word on what's been in the news, Dave. I'd seen on our session planner that you've absolutely filled this with news items. So do you want to take us through some of the key ones for this week?
Yeah, there's a couple. There's one that I think I'll leave to the end because it might nicely segue into what we're looking at in relation to charities and donors and re-engagement and things like that. So I'll come on to that one shortly. But the first one, quite an interesting one, really, that I just kind of picked up on this week that I thought might be interesting to share, really. Was the recent High Court case between Wolf and Veal, if anybody caught that one. And it relates to, in essence, we're all aware of increasing claims for compensation for where there's potentially infringements of data protection law. We see it all the time with some of our clients, whether it's small data breaches and bits and pieces around the edges there, and you're getting all these compensation claims, predominantly driven, some of them are predominantly driven by claims management companies and so on and so forth. Anyway, this case basically was dismissed from the High Court by Master the Cloud, as it was implausible that any distress had been suffered. So I was thinking, well, what's this case about? I thought I'd read into it a little bit more. Now, the case relates around to something we've probably all done, if anybody's actually being truly honest with themselves, and it relates to an email that contained an attachment that was sent to the wrong recipient. So I'm assuming we've all done something similar, or been in a similar position, or know of somebody who's done something similar in that sense. So it's basically a single email with an attachment sent to the wrong recipient. Now, the attachment was a letter and a statement of account. It was sent by a law firm demanding payment on behalf of their client from other individuals. But that went to the wrong recipient. The recipient, the unintended recipient, promptly responded and confirmed that it was deleted. However, the individuals that were affected, or the individual that should have received that the information relating to themselves, claimed, and the very typical kind of let's throw everything at it kind of claim, the claim misuse of confidential information, breach of confidence, negligence, and a host of other things in this kind of like this going for everything approach. The claimants also said that they felt ill at the information being disclosed to another individual, and the fact that they lost sleep with worry. However, the court did hold, or the court held, possibly is a better way of saying it, that there's no credible case of distress was proved, and that the claim was quite frankly trivial in nature. In that sense, they said there was nothing especially personal within the attachment. For example, there's no banking details or medical matters within the attachment there. And there was no further evidence of transmission or misuse. And therefore, the High Court then felt it was plainly exaggerated. So this is kind of getting to kind of looking at claims management companies, all these kind of ambulance chases that are coming through. But it's also looking at setting this kind of de minimis level for compensation claims. And there's been a few around. We've not been doing the podcast long enough. We've been doing that for about a year, just around about a year. But for those, and I know with within the company we've spoken about them, possibly raised them previously, you've got things like case law, like Vidal Hall versus Google, that's hanging around, which said that you could claim for distress without pecuniary loss or without financial loss. You had Lloyd and Google, which basically said along the lines of a loss of personal data could constitute damage, as long as the damage wasn't trivial in that kind of sense. So this is kind of really getting to more kind of that there really must be a de minimis rule. You can't just kind of make claims for compensation where minor breaches are nothing more than fanciful in that sense. And I thought it was quite interesting kind of raising. I don't know if you've come across it, Ollie.
No, I hadn't come across it, but you've given us a wonderful account there. I certainly welcome, I think, really, because I don't know about anyone else on the session. If anyone wants to jump in, please do. But we've seen a massive increase in these ambulance chasing type claims. You know, you've disclosed my email to my neighbour, and now I'm losing sleep over it. Please, could I have, you know, £15,000? How about no? So it's welcome. I see here you also wanted to talk. I'm just going to segue.
If I just jump into there, Ollie, there was just in the chat just sort of popped up. Somebody said, "Can I provide the case name?" It's Wolf, Wolfe versus Veal, Veal. It's a High Court case. If we get talking about other stuff, we'll try and find the link and pop it into the chat for everybody.
Yeah, no worries. Good stuff. I see you wanted to talk about the ICO special category data guidance, though. Quick word on that, maybe?
Yeah, it's just because I'd seen it popped on my LinkedIn feed, really, so I thought I'd have a quick look at it. The only purpose of really highlighting is it's a useful little bit of guidance there around special category data. It looks to things like rights and freedoms and what they may mean. So we've certainly got the right to freedom of thought, conscience, religion. You've got the freedom of expression, freedom of assembly, freedom of association, right to bodily integrity, right to respect for private and family life, freedom from discrimination, and so on. So it kind of helps kind of set some of the scenes with fundamental rights and freedoms. It also breaks down things like, for those that might be understanding, well, are we processing things like genetic data, biometric data, or even sat there pondering what is health information? In that sense, and it does provide some kind of thoughts and considerations around that. For example, with health data, it goes to looking at health data, obviously covers past health, current health, or even future health statuses, includes things like health history, medical opinions, diagnosis, clinical treatment, test results, data from fitness trackers, information collected when registering for health services, appointment details, reminders which may tell you about something about the individual's health status, and so on. So it's worth reading just to see where the just to see the opinions and the kind of the any guidance that the ICO may provide. It may assist, it may solidify your thought processes around special category data, but it's just guidance I've come across recently. That the like I said, it was in the LinkedIn feed today, just so I thought it was useful just to pick up on that and give pointers for that one. I've been a little bit more organised with this one. I do have the link, so I can pop that into the chat section there for anybody that wishes to have a resource or to go and have a nosy around that section there. So I'll just pop that one into the chat so everybody's got that. I will come back and find the case for that I mentioned earlier in relation to Wolf and Veal. I will find that one and pop that into the chat as well. But I just thought the one about special category was interesting because it was there. Yep, now, I'm just jumping in, assuming that nobody's got anything to say on that.
It's fine. Don't you worry. You can steamroller on. All I was going to say is there's a nice little segue here. In fact, there are two nice segues because arguably special category data includes union memberships, doesn't it? So do you want to tell us a little bit about this union fine?
Does, yeah. I was going to try and come up with some kind of uniting the GDPR and PECA.
No.
I thought I might get barred from any further kind of podcast and so on. But anyway, Unite, it's a recent one. I went fishing around just in the ICO's enforcement. Again, unfortunately, it just relates to a breach of PECA in that sense of the Privacy and Electronic Communications Regulations. And in essence, Unite had undertaken, they didn't believe actually that they were undertaking any form of direct marketing, but the ICO held up they did. And an investigation showed that they'd contacted 57,655 subscribers to Unite, but they were also registered on TPS in that sense, and it resulted quite astonishingly, really, considering we got nearly 58,000, shall we say, or 57,500 if you want to wind it back a little bit. Out of 57,500 unsolicited calls to people on TPS, it only resulted in 27 complaints, and those 27 complaints were taken seriously by the ICO, of which the Unite Union is facing a fine of 45,000, taken into consideration all the other factors. Unite, funnily enough, tried to claim that the calls were in accordance with their rule book, which required Unite or the union to notify the members of service and benefits that fall under the union membership in that sense. And what they're trying to do was raise awareness of free life assurance and protection review. But that review came from a third party business, which was selling life insurance. So to me, it appears slap bang in the direct marketing kind of bracket, but Unite felt it didn't. They felt that it was in line with their rule book, and consequently, they didn't really have valid consent either. We can look at maybe valid consent if anybody's got issues with that as we transit through into engaging or re-engaging with lab supporters. But the ICO held that they didn't have valid consent for what they were doing in that sense. And to be fair, consent was bundled with their subscriber membership in that sense. The other bits that was quite interesting, and again really relevant when we're looking at either consent or our own privacy policies for engaging supporters or donors, is the fact that we can't kind of be too generic or rather bland with our descriptions of things. So in the Unite case, the ICO really kind of emphasises that it's not valid to say that we may kind of share information with similar organisations or partners or selected third parties or anything else that really doesn't mean anything to anybody who's reading it. But again, I won't stray too much, otherwise I'll be going too far into what we're here to talk about.
Well, more importantly, there are people who are concerned on the chat that you might be turning blue.
I've got also very asking,
also asking if you've had your double espresso this morning.
I've had just two.
I'm sure you have. Well, I'll tell you what, there's the segue. So let's make the most of it and let's get stuck in. So really what we're here to talk about today primarily is the charity sector and more specifically fundraising, because arguably, obviously, that's one of their main activities. It's also one of the compliance hotbeds, really, let's say. So let's talk a little bit about that. So we've got four key areas we want to talk about, one of which is how to stay compliant in fundraising. So I guess that's what we were talking about a second ago, so we can start there. Also looking at buying data from a broker, which, you know, is risks in and of itself. And then there are two points which really was the reason we wanted to bring Sam in, which are working with a lottery provider, so hopefully some good insights there, and also talking about fundraising platforms and potentially payment providers there. So we'll get to all that in due course, but first of all, let's talk a little bit about fundraising campaigns, shall we? Now, we've dealt with a huge number of charity clients. We've become really quite experienced at designing these campaigns, I like to think anyway. And but really, you know, the key, Dave, has to be to cut through everything around this. The key has to be proper consent management and proper transparency mechanisms, right?
I would agree. It's coming to understanding what you're doing and why you're doing, the lawful basis for doing that. And if we're going through consent, make sure that we understand what valid consent is, make sure we understand the requirements and the mechanisms, not just the definition of consent, but the element of consent itself and the management of consent in that sense. Consent is only one element. We're not certainly just going to be talking about consent throughout the sessions. Consent is only one element of that. But if you are relying on consent, well, what does it look like? Can you evidence it? What are your mechanisms in place to maintain consent and so on?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think it is still relatively, baffling maybe is the word, that at this point there are still, you know, issues around understanding that consent is a requirement for direct marketing. You know, we still talk to businesses regularly. I think possibly the issue is maybe that direct marketing as a concept is perhaps not sufficiently understood. Now, fundraising obviously I think is more clear cut, but even within that, you know, if you're just promoting the activities of the charity and just sending out a newsletter, do you need consent for that?
For sure. I think you hit on a valid point of, well, what actually is the definition of direct marketing? And do our activities fall within the definition of direct marketing? Now, the definition of direct marketing itself sits within the Data Protection Act 2018, I think section 122, subparagraph 5, but it's added to by the ICO's guidance. They've actually got a code of practice, haven't they, on direct marketing that further expands on the definition of direct marketing. As far as I'm aware, Ollie, I'm not sure if that code, last time I was in that code and looking at the code itself, it was only at consultation stage. Has that actually come out now? Has anybody seen the fully approved version of the direct marketing code, or is it still in consultation process?
I am happy to be corrected on this point, but I believe it's still in consultation. I believe there has been an updated copy since, because they have, one thing I picked up on last time there was a tweak to it, was the fact that, so if we all remember, a while back, the latest code of practice had significantly expanded that concept of direct marketing that you talk about, Dave. And it even went so far as to include regulatory communications in that.
It did, yeah.
And so, you know, if you're sending out a message to do with you know, your activities as a regulated provider, whatever industry or sector you're in, but obviously it's going to be applicable to the charity sector, heavily regulated, then those communications might be caught and might require consent. Now, I believe that they've dialed that back now to say, well, actually, hang on a second, let's have a think about this, because we're possibly setting the bar a bit too high here. And I have to say, I'd agree. In the latest one, they even gave the example, sorry, in the one previous to the latest one, they'd even given the example that a text from your GP surgery saying, make sure to get your 5 a day in, could constitute direct marketing because you're promoting a healthy eating initiative. Now, to my mind, that's I don't want to sound like I'm on LBC all of a sudden, but to my mind, that's going too far. You know, there has to be some balance to it. Yes, the consent mechanism is an important control, because the last thing you want is everyone marketing, you know, their wares and products and services to you. But there has to be a balance there, I would think. So, yeah, I believe it's still in draft, although, as I say, happy to be challenged on that. I think it is probably important to dial it back a little bit, because we've seen what I think is an overexpansion. And I think a lot of the interpretations across Europe are more restrictive on some of these points. And they do sort of say, you know, there is clearly a need for consent for direct marketing purposes, but your direct marketing might not extend to what is purely, you know, updating people about your activities, for instance.
For sure. I mean, it certainly is a wide definition. And I think some of the requirements to understand whether you are direct marketing and not, sometimes it's quite clear. And I think sometimes it could be come down to specifically the communication that you're sending out and how that's put together and the words, the emphasis that you may be using and so on. I don't think in all cases it's really, I don't think it's quite clear cut in some cases that it's either is or it isn't. I think some of it comes down to, which is why it's often quite difficult to understand which bits are direct marketing is, what is it? In the sense, what is direct marketing? And secondly, what is the content of the communication, and does that amount to direct marketing? Because potentially the words nudge factors, whether you're trying to raise awareness of ideals, aims, promotional activity, and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, for sure. I tell you what, just quickly, Douglas makes a fantastic point actually in the chat, saying that I doubt they will release the direct marketing guidance of the government's consultation on GDPR. Wants to redefine direct marketing so they can send more promotional emails to their electorate. And genuinely, at this point, would any of us be surprised if that was actually one of the things involved? Because that was one of the things actually that sort of was quite defining in this interpretation of direct marketing, because the SNP got fined for calling people up and trying to swing votes, didn't they, about seven or eight years ago, something like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, I would have said actually, I think most political parties have been caught out by some element of direct marketing. If I recall, I don't think it's just solely the SNP. I'm sure Labour and even the Conservatives have had minor infringements or some form of infringements with direct marketing and sending communications out.
Quite. Well, I'll tell you what, let's move this on, because you talked about the consent requirements there, and really obtaining valid consent, I think, is one of the issues which is at the heart of buying data, right? Because ultimately, there's nothing that stops you outright from purchasing a marketing list, a set of contact details for a particular pool of prospects. But it is very difficult to do compliantly. I'm not going to say it's borderline impossible, but it is difficult, isn't it, Dave?
Well, it is, because it's all around the due diligence that you have to go to. You can't, and to be fair, that possibly helps to, well, what is due diligence without kind of trying to overanalyze everything. But the due diligence, you can't just purchase a list from an organization that says, yes, we're compliant, because just accepting somebody says, yes, we're compliant, isn't due diligence in itself, and it's insufficient as a measure to show that you understand what you're purchasing from an organisation, or whether they're actually compliant themselves in that kind of sense. When we're looking at due diligence around purchasing data, like you're quite right, Ollie, the law on the GDPR doesn't say you can't do it, so you can do it in that sense, but you just have to still comply with the GDPR. You still have to make sure that the measures are in place are appropriate, and to carefully think about and undertake, let's say, appropriate due diligence. So for example, if you're looking at who's compiled the data, if you're going to a data provider, for example, and there are out there in that sense, if you're going to those individuals to purchase cold data lists for them, well, where did their lists come from in that sense? Did they take it directly from the individual themselves and provided sufficient previous information to them themselves, or were they collating it from a range of different providers? So is in essence the middleman. with no direct relationship with the data subject. So then it allows you, then you're kind of getting into the ballpark of going, well, we've now got a cold data supplier in that sense. We're not fully sure where the data's come from, and potentially not sure whether the consent mechanisms by that provider is also very use meets the requirements.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, ultimately, even sort of regardless, I guess, of really trying to, you know, adhere to the gold standard, purely from an operational perspective and from I guess, a value for money perspective, you have to conduct certain level of due diligence, because arguably you could buy a list of contact details and they could be all registered on the TPS and haven't provided any form of consent or anything. You're completely dependent on the broker to ensure that that's not the case, and that actually it is a viable list that contains people who have opted in, who have provided consent, which is sufficiently informed, because often this is where it falls down, I would think.
So some of the difficulties I found when I was working in the charity sector and looking at purchasing cold data lists for fundraising requirements and that kind of thing, we're going out to a number of data providers. When you started to try to do due diligence and ask them about, well, where did they get the data from? Is it fully opted in? If they're collating data from their partners, who are their partners? You then get this kind of wall where it's kind of, well, I can't possibly tell you that information. It's commercially sensitive, and so on and so forth. So you get to this point of, I'm trying to do due diligence, but the organisation I'm trying to purchase the data off is kind of giving me all the assurances, but with no evidence to back that up, and not demonstrable evidence to show that the lists are fully opted in. Not saying all providers work that way, but I've certainly come across trying to do due diligence and go through that process to meet this wall of, well, it is compliant, it is opted in, but we can't tell you who our providers are for commerciality reasons.
Yeah, well, we all know that's more or less the case, and Philip is re-emphasising that, making sure that your consent is sufficiently granular to ensure that your charity has actually been named, or I guess at the very least that your category of charity, maybe, because you could possibly extend it, but really, I mean, that's, again, this is part of the issue. That's when you're getting yourself into unnecessarily complex territory, you'd have thought. But as you say, we've all worked with them, and to be honest, we've all been on the receiving end, I'd assume, of that type of communication where you're not entirely sure at what point you actually agreed to it. So I guess that really one of the keys is, first of all, as you say, due diligence, whether it's an outright, you know, list of contact details, or even if you're using one of the providers that might do something like wealth screening for you, because I know that's increasingly popular. Doing that due diligence, and then I guess is designing a good strategy to allow you to really legitimize and make full use of your data set, right?
Well, for sure. When we're looking at cold data purchase, you can look in the basic senses that I'm trying to purchase name and address details on somebody. But you can also, you're also kind of dabbling in the same market where you're buying variables to enhance your own records. So I've got Oliver Rear on my database. He's done something with us previously, but I want to know more about him in order to determine whether he's got a great propensity to give. You mentioned about wealth screening and things, or you mentioned there may well be other variables that I'm trying to ascertain. Are you interested in big charitable events, such as we're looking for people to climb the Great Wall of China, or those kind of outdoor physical events in that sense? Are we looking at you offering, yeah, and I know we're looking at talking about lottery later, for example, can we get variables on you that may indicate a greater propensity to support the organisation through lottery membership as opposed to a different form of regular giving?
Yeah, for sure. Well, I'll tell you what, on that note, should we talk a little bit about lotteries? Because I appreciate that we've been doing a lot of nattering and poor Zams here, having to sit quietly while we rabbit on about all sorts.
I'm enjoying it.
Excellent. Well, I'll tell you what, yeah, we'll talk about lotteries a bit, because you guys have a wealth of experience on that front. It'd be good to hear from you. I guess one of the things that, I mean, personally, I'm interested in, you may have a view on this or you may not, but I feel like the shift really, and I guess, Dave, you might be able to echo this, is that we've seen a shift, particularly within the charities, from traditional lotteries really to sort of more of a raffle system, right?
Yes. I mean, I think it got really popular start of the first lockdown. So excluding charities here for a second, but generally a lot of people who, you know, were not able to go into work, they're working from home, or they just, maybe they were on furlough, for example, began to start setting up competitions, whether it be via social media such as Facebook, or whether they create their own website, etc. And they were just trying to generate more business either way. And then we noticed charities, obviously, were getting very popular with the charity industry as well. So a lot of charities were approaching us and saying, look, we want to be able to offer a lottery raffle online. But it wasn't so much like the lottery you see on TV. It was so much like, you know, we're going to give away prizes, we're going to give away cars, or we want to give away money, etc. And we were able, luckily, to facilitate payments for this. There's not many providers out there who will facilitate payments for the lottery or for raffle tickets, and we are actually one of them. So we started to set up raffles and lotteries for merchants and for charities, helping them to take payment, you know, not just for donations, but actually doing the lotteries on the side as well of that.
Yeah, I mean, well, you obviously have a background in the charity sector, Dave, as well. So I assume you've had some pretty hands-on experience with all of this. But you know, we've worked on some of these products before, and they can be a bit of a minefield, really, because you've also got the Gambling Commission rules to comply with, and that's something which is alien to me personally. But
you've got to be if you're looking at lotteries and things, you've got to be compliant with the Gambling Commission in that sense. But if you're looking at lottery generally, you've still got your other compliance elements, not just with the Gambling Commission. But if your lottery is outsourced to a provider, have you been through again the due diligence with the provider? Have you according to the GDPR got appropriate contract or contractual or other legal kind of process in place for a legally enforceable agreement, and so on? So you've got all your due diligence measures around understanding who you're working with and why and how they're going to have the data, and all the measures around that from the compliance point in that sense, as well as like you said, the Gambling Commission. From myself, from a background when I worked in the charity sector, we weren't a large enough, we were kind of a regional charity catchment bound, because it's within the hospice sector, so we weren't necessarily kind of we weren't doing raffles in the sense of electronic raffles. We were doing a lottery electronically, and we were doing raffles in the traditional form of the sense, where there'd be a range of prizes and we'd mail out raffle books twice a year. So you'd have a Christmas appeal and a summer appeal, that kind of thing. In that sense, so we've not necessarily, well, my background is not necessarily in, like you see on the TV, where you can, if everybody you pay £5 for a ticket, you might have a chance of winning £1 million house in Cornwall or wherever it was.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I've definitely seen this on the rise. The one that keeps it's probably to do, well, in fact, it's not probably to do, I know full well that it's all to do with the cookies that I will have accepted, but I regularly get charitable lotteries for like signed football memorabilia and that sort of thing. So you buy like a lot of have many tickets to enter, and you know, you might get a chance to win some sort of signed football shirt or something like that. So yeah, no, definitely on the rise. I don't know. Well, it's, I don't know if either of you had anything else you wanted to contribute that. But I guess ultimately, really, it still falls into your fundraising operations, right? Ultimately, so in terms of the controls around that, there's not going to be a substantial difference.
No, for sure. All I was going to add on that was kind of bringing it back to the point of, because today's session is really about re-engaging with lapsed donors, isn't it? And how we do that and some of the measures, whether that's through lottery, raffles, whether it's an online kind of doing this, like you mentioned about trying to win a football shirt, or the traditional form of lotteries where you buy a number and it's drawn weekly for a range of different amounts. That kind of thing, or whether it's a traditional form of lottery or any other kind of fundraising, direct marketing engagement, whether you're trying to get people to, as I mentioned, physical events, go and climb a mountain somewhere, run, cycle, or more traditional forms of fundraising, community-based events and so on. But it's when you're looking at trying to re-engage with donors, that's about, I was kind of, it's fine talking about lottery and different types of products and stuff, but how do you use that to re-engage? with your donors? And in order to do that, what do you need to consider?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, ultimately, I guess that's where I was ramping up to, which was to talk a little bit about the controls that you can have in place, which really, you know, a lot of it's going to be about the strategy that you design in the first place to get that re-engagement. So I guess, David, really, what I'd like from you is some of your key tips, I guess, you know, some of your key insights from having worked not only previously in the sector, but also obviously we still work with a host of charities, and making sure that you can effectively, you know, maximize your engagement or re-engagement, as the case may be,
for sure,
continue to do that compliantly.
There's probably a range of things. As we always do, we run out of time eventually, don't we? So let's try and kind of jump into this without going too far. It's not in any particular order, so if anybody's taking notes, don't think this is the way to do it. But one of the problems I generally find, and it is a compliance issue in essence, is making sure that you've got proper management of your database, proper management of who's got access to your data, why have they got access to your data, what are they doing to update your CRM systems or your contact management systems and so on. Because I often find that there's pockets of data on CRM systems where you're not quite sure whether you can communicate with them or not. You've got things like do not contact flags and so on. But what does do not contact actually mean? I mean, now that sounds absolutely silly. I'm sure we could all kind of guess what do not contact means. But does do not contact mean that the individual's objected to direct marketing? Does do not contact mean, well, actually, it's a trustee and the trustee is aware of our activities, they just don't need communicating through the post? Does do not contact mean, well, actually, the major donor program means this individual's going through some kind of donor journey or some stewardship in order to have greater ask at the end, and therefore does do not contact mean actually somebody else is warming them up to doing something? So when we're looking from a compliant point, we need to understand what we're doing with the data in order to be compliant with the GDPR. I mean, it's got to be accurate, it's got to be up to date, you've got to have data integrity there, but also how are we managing, how are we controlling that? If we've got a turnover of staff and we're giving people free access to update things on the CRM system, they'll need some guidance and control measures around that. Just a simple do not contact without context behind it doesn't mean anything. And in essence, if you're not careful, all you're getting yourself to a point is to a position where I can't communicate with people because we've got flags that we don't know what they mean. And because charity sectors are generally a bit more risk averse, they kind of go, if it says do not contact, we best not contact them in that kind of sense. And I find all those kind of problems around the actual management and understanding of data is a bit of a problem, because once you need to get that sorted out in order to then start doing your analysis from which you can then spring forward to with the engagement campaigns, with uplift campaigns, with second number campaigns, if you're looking at lottery or trying to do an enhanced direct debit ask campaign, you need to get your data right. Your data needs to be managed, your data needs to be accurate, and it needs to be controlled so we know what we're looking at.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a good, very good point. I think one of the things that I've, you know, come across a lot, and as you say, part of this is about the management of your information in the first instance and making sure that it's all accurate and up to date. But one of the things that we've come across a lot is, as everyone here will know, presumably, you know, there's that nuance under PECA, which is that, you know, emails to obtain, well, it's not actually under PECA, it's under the interpretive guidance, but the nuance that emails to obtain consent for direct marketing are themselves considered to be direct marketing, right? So you're in a bit of a catch-22 there of, well, if you have missed the opportunity to get consent from this person, or it has lapsed perhaps and you've not re-engaged sufficiently quickly enough, how do you go about actually obtaining or re-obtaining that consent? And, you know, we've gone through the process with clients before and they just sort of say, well, we can't do it then, can we? You sort of say, well, hang on, let's think about this, because you've still got the ability to use, you know, phone calls, because they don't require consent. As long as they're not on the TPS, you can go ahead and do that. Obviously, you know, physical, you know, postal marketing is very much on the out, I assume, but it's certainly, you know, less effective. But again, you need to look at these ways that you can maximize and generate engagement, don't you?
Well, you do. And just to kind of clarify a couple of points in there, I don't think direct marketing is dead by postal communications by any measure of the means. When I was in the charity sector, and I'm happy to be proven wrong, But when I was in the charity sector, we always got far better response rates, uplift rates, and so on through direct marketing, through postal, than we did ever through use of emails in that sense. Now, telephone's its own little thing, so we can certainly look at telephones as well. But you're absolutely right. If you're kind of going, well, I've lost the ability to communicate with somebody through an email, well, what are the channels that are open to you? You quite validly mentioned the use of the telephone. You can do that under legitimate interest. You can do personal communications under legitimate interest. So the starting point for that would be, well, did we set out? And I appreciate this is a few years ago when I worked in the charity sector, when this kind of all kind of came about local bases and things. It was a kind of a bit of a seismic shift. I think following one of the larger charities that we needed consent for everything. Now, if you've got consent for everything and you've lost consent for everything, then it's arguable as to how you do that. I'm not saying it's impossible, but it's arguable about how you do that. But if you still retain the ability to communicate through postal communications or telephone communications, then the loss of the email itself is not necessarily that much of an issue, because you can try and re-engage, try and communicate with the individual through the channels that are still remaining to you to try and get that back.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, I stand corrected on the postal front. Mark agrees with you. He says that a large percentage of their customers prefer engagement through post, and response rates are always above 85%. So I absolutely stand corrected on that front. I just assumed that with the way we're going in terms of digital media, that was on the way out. But I stand corrected. There are a couple of interesting points in the chat. Philippa wanted a little bit more on telephone comms. We'll come to that. But there are a couple of points about re-engaging. One, in terms of the duration of time between engagement, and also on corporate donors, which I do want to get into. And just so we're keeping track, I do also want to come back to your point, Dave, about managing your CRM and your database. And actually, one of the things I wanted to speak to Zam about on this session was, managing, I guess, your integrations with your payment provider and making sure that that's all running smoothly. So we'll get to all that very shortly. But there's a question directly for you from Christine, Dave, which is that she asks, how far back can we go to re-engage with donors, i.e. last donation 4, 5, 10 years ago? So what are your thoughts on that? I mean, to my mind, again, it's about designing the campaign that is going to allow you to get, the maximum, the highest chance, rather, of re-engaging. But what are your thoughts on that?
I would look to, if we're talking postal communications and we kept postal as legitimate interest in that sense, we've still got the door open to communicate with people on the database. There's various steps that you probably want to go through. If you're going back as far as 10 years, there's probably an element of data cleansing. You certainly don't want to cause offence by mailing anybody that might have passed, or upsetting the family because you're trying to communicate with somebody that might have passed. So you maybe want to consider an element of data cleansing to make sure, whether it's using the National Change of Address Register, whether it's using some of the, they're only marketing files and 100% accurate, but whether you want to look at some of the deceased files that are available through the READ group and so on around deceased records. Likewise, I would then probably try, like you said, I think the approach is quite key. If you've got the ability to communicate, you've got your segmented data, you know you've got the ability to communicate because there's none of these wayward kind of flags on there that's kind of skew-whiffing what you're looking at, but you've got a segmented data that's potentially a little bit old. I would probably do a little bit more analysis, because it comes to the point for me, and I quite like data, to be fair, but what I do like to consider really is when we talk about lapsed, or we're talking about re-engagement from lapsed, well, what is lapsed? And therefore, we're trying to find whether the individual's engaged with the organisation or not. And this comes to the point that actually you're going to get some individuals that are engaged, and you get some individuals that will make a one-off donation, and in their minds got no intention to give any further or any kind of direct kind of engagement with the charity. It's just been a one-off donation support. And it'd be interesting to see whether there's any analysis that could help kind of cut that down a little bit. Now, I'm not necessarily saying not to communicate with them in that sense. If you want to try to communicate with them, I would certainly work through, I'd certainly have your strategy there, and then I would break it down into segments and do trial sends. So if you are inadvertently going to upset people, you'd find out by doing a trial send of I've noticed they're 50, 100, 200, depending on the size of your database, obviously. But doing trial ascends in a lot smaller segments and see if that causes offence, and then to kind of slowly increase and lift that upwards from that point in that sense. But I would certainly be trying to do a lot more analysis, trying to find out what their engagement, the point of contact with us, the engagement they've had with us in the past, because it's trying to make sure that we've got value of, value for money when our spends, and it's more likely, I'm not saying it's impossible, it's more likely to re-engage people who had stronger engagement than people who've made a one-off donation with very little intention to give in the longer term. In that sense,
for sure, for sure. Yeah, no, that's absolutely. I completely agree with you on that. I just wanted to pick up this point. I mentioned previously about re-engaging with corporate business to business donors, but with named email addresses. And I guess what this comes down to is we do have the concept of the corporate subscriber, don't we? Which is provide you with an exemption from getting consent. In direct marketing context, but obviously there's that nuance, the caveat that if it's a personal email address, are you potentially dealing with a sole trader or a limited partnership that's under the threshold for a corporate subscriber? And I guess that really sort of comes down to it. It can be really quite complex. I mean, I know that we've dealt with this before on behalf of some of our clients, where they might deal with a large number of sole traders. That makes your consent management really tricky, doesn't it?
Well, the corporate subscriber in the basic senses, it does get a bit more complicated, but in the basic senses, if you just analyse your data and it's got an at dataprotectionpeople.com, it is a corporate subscriber. It's the difficulties where you've got, and it's not always the case, obviously, but obviously there is some kind of clear markers that you can look to, but the corporate subscriber may well be a sole trader, and if they're a sole trader or a small partnership in that sense, then it will be considered an individual, and you will need to make sure that you meet the requirements of PECA. Because as you know, and I'm sure you can expand on as well, Ollie, that consent for B2B, well, you don't technically need consent for B2B marketing. As long as it's to corporates, you can still communicate with them through B2B. You've still got to give the opportunity to unsubscribe. So there's still got to be an unsubscribe mechanism in there. But in essence, B2B, with individuals that are in essence agents of the employer, the rules around that are not as tight as if you're trying to communicate with the consumer.
Yeah, absolutely. And one point I was going to pick up on, actually, and I'd lost my train of thought, was I completely agree with you on sending basically a test batch, or at least doing small batches to test the response rate. I mean, Mark's saying that, you know, you're always going to get a few non-engagers, or you might even get, you know, a small number of complaints. So it's always good to have your backup in terms of how you're going to deal with that.
And I think that's a very, very, very valid point. Without kind of going off this, if you're trying to say I'm using legitimate interests as my postal communications, what I'd like to know is, I've got my own thoughts on it, but what I'd like to know is how many people actually use non-responses as a justification for the legitimate interest. Now, that might sound a little odd, but if you're doing direct marketing campaigns and you're sending lottery tickets or raffle tickets or appeal campaigns and things like that, how many non-responses to a Christmas campaign do you accept before you realise they're just not going to respond to a Christmas campaign? Or how many physical lottery ticket raffle books do you need to send an individual before you realise, well, they're not actually buying any of them? Does that mean they're actually engaged with that kind of part of the organisation? And therefore, should we not look to non-responses and tailor our communication around what individuals don't necessarily respond to? Now, there may well be a degree of testing in that. You might get somebody who's not responded to a raffle at Christmas because of holidays, because of inertia, well, they intended to buy them, but Christmas being crazy this year because of COVID and all the rest of it. So you'd need more than just the fact they've not responded on one occasion. But how many occasions do you accept a non-response to before you kind of go, but these are the, whatever we've done, however we've tried to put the pack together, however we're trying to get the engagement and the nudge factors and things within our creative, they're just not buying raffle tickets. So surely as part of your legitimate interest assessment, you should be saying, after X amount of communications of a non-response to a lottery, a non-response to a raffle or some other form of communications, well, let's just not keep knocking on that door. It's not going to open if you've tried it over so many times and they've just not initiated, they're just not kind of engaged with you on that point.
No, for sure. I think it's a really, really good point. Mark supporting you on that, saying how many times you need to poke a cobra before it bites you. You have to be careful before the donor starts screaming harassment, which is Obviously, a very good point. So just before we move on to the systems point, because I do want to get to that, do you want to just give us a word on the telephone communications aspect? I mean, broadly, the premise, right, is that you don't need consent for telephone communications where it's direct marketing. You just have to make sure they're not on the TPS, and you have to honour any opt-outs. Realistically, getting consent is probably preferable, because then that's far more clear-cut, but it's not technically required, though, is it?
I would think through every step with the telephone communications. And the reason I say that is because it can easily cause offence. And you can easily address some of that by making sure that you've got a good script, because most of the telephone campaigns that I ran when I was in the sector, we outsource the telephone calls. So you need to make sure you've got an appropriate script, that your script's compliant, the individual identifies that they're working on your behalf and they're getting paid for it, and so on and so forth, because there's requirements around that. And then have some mechanism for them to check with the organisation, because we were receiving at that point, I've just been called by this person, and so on, saying that they're doing this for you. Is that right? Am I not being it's not fraud and that kind of stuff. And also make sure that there's appropriate times for calling, make sure that there's appropriate number of attempts to call, and maybe a period between each call. So again, it comes back to the point that you're maybe not harassing the caller, sorry, the recipient in that sense. Every step needs to be carefully kind of thought through. But the difficulty is with it, when we ran telephone campaigns, taking out everything and trying to be compliant, we actually got stunkingly good uplift rates to direct debit campaigns, to second number on the lotteries and stuff, and it is actually quite beneficial in that sense. So you've got this difficulty point really between I know it works, but how do we make sure if it's going to work we do it in the best way possible, in the most compliant way possible? And that to me still comes back to understanding your data, understanding who's opted out, who said no in that sense. Have you got any dead ends that we can't address? Have we started out from the very outset asking for consent for telephone? Because if we've got consent for telephone, as you mentioned there, Ollie, that it might work. But bearing in mind, was consent valid? Have we managed consent appropriately and that kind of stuff? Even if they've got consent, it's a bit of a tricky one between whether they've got consent and whether they've subscribed on the telephone preference service, and does one override the other? So there's possibly a little element around there that you need to kind of consider and think about. But in essence, yes, you can do direct marketing through the telephone, but just think through each step carefully. And if you do and you get it right, then you kind of you can have quite decent rewards with it. And I've certainly seen really good response rates, as I mentioned, to either direct debit uplifts because of being spending £5 a month with the organisation, or donating £5 a month with a charity over a period of time, and we felt it was we'll try an uplift campaign, or likewise with the second number for the lottery, and we got some really really good uplift rates as a consequence of that.
No, for sure, it is valuable. Philip is saying that interested because they currently apply consent for telephone marketing under PECA. Please correct me, Dave, but I'm almost certain that technically you don't, but arguably applying consent is only going to lead to a higher standard, frankly, of managing your information, and it's going to cut down on your risk of complaints in that sense massively.
Absolutely. I would agree with that. If you go consent for telephone, you're going to get lower number of complaints, especially where you can evidence consent, because then if somebody does make a complaint, you can show them the fact that they've agreed to it. If you do consent well, then yes, it'll help, but the problem is not many people will consent to telephone calls, so therefore your base will be lower. Whereas if you use legitimate interest, your base for calling may be higher, but as a consequence of that, you may generate more complaints, and therefore you need some measure to manage the complaints process and make sure that the process of using calls isn't done in a way that will cause offence. But you don't technically need consent for telephone calls under PECA. You just need to screen it against TPS or CTPS if you're calling corporates.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I guess in that sense, it's almost a bit of a risk management exercise, isn't it, really? I think actually it's one of the things that most stands out to me, you know, when I think about the PECA and the fact that it's potentially a bit outdated, because fundamentally, even though it has been updated, it is a piece of statute from 2003. And the fact that really, you know, under the law, emails are perceived to be more intrusive than phone calls, I think is a bit of a hangover from a pre-internet necessarily, but an early internet, shall we say, stage, I think opinions have shifted on that front. Personally, I'd much rather get spam emails than receive a phone call. Like, and I think a lot of people, particularly in my age bracket, would feel the same. I'm conscious of time, so I did want to get onto this point. If you do want to jump, anyone wants to jump in on that, then please do. I've just noticed Douglas has popped a quite a lengthy comment in there. I'll get to that in just a second, if that's all right. But I did want to talk about systems, and particularly, I guess the point that you can probably fill us in on most, Sam, here is really integration between your payment provider and your payment platform and your wider systems, and whether you had any insights on that, were there any particular issues that you've come across and some of the solutions that you can offer on that front, really.
Yeah, for sure. So obviously, being in this industry, technology is a key factor for charities as well in regards to taking online donations. So what we developed is a solution where it's fairly straightforward and fairly easy for charities to receive donation. And basically what we do is we create them a donation portal, should we call it. And then it's a case of integrating that portal, integrating that donation page onto the charity's website or onto the charity's social media platforms. So we have our API, and what that does, it allows obviously donors to literally just within a click of a button, click donate now, and then it takes you to a payment page, which is hosted by ourselves. And then from there, it's very straightforward in terms of for the donator to make a donation, the amount that they want, make the payment, make the donation, sorry. And then what happens is donation goes into the charity merchant account, we call it. So in terms of integrating it, we've done a lot of work on this in the past, and it's the same concept what we have for actual corporate businesses or merchant accounts, integrating the payment side of things into the website, into the charity website. So we've mastered it, and we've done it over the years, and it's the same concept that we use for corporate companies and for charities. So it's seamless, it's straightforward, and it's easy. And in terms of integration, we've done that for we've done it for many years anyway. So yeah, like I said, we have our API that we use. So in terms of integrating our payments page onto the charity's website, we handle all that for the charity as well.
Lovely. Well, I guess that's really, really helpful for a lot of the organisations that rely on that. It must be a massive benefit for them. I don't know, Dave, if you had anything to raise on that particularly, or generally on your management of systems and some of the ones that you may have come across in your time potentially.
Yeah, it's just the normal kind of compliance measures for systems. If it's something that's involving personal data, not forgetting the fact that we're still obligated, even through using suppliers, to make sure that it's appropriate technical and organisational measures are in place. So if two systems are talking, how do you do that securely? And is it kind of an encrypted API between the systems, or is it not? How do we make sure that the our infrastructure, shall we say, is as resilient as it can be? Does the data exist purely with it to provide? So if you're outsourcing your information, say, to a lottery provider, does the lottery database purely sit with the lottery provider? What's their resilience? What's the criticality of that information should the provider run into disaster recovery, business continuity matters? And what would the impact upon the organisation for that? And looking at some of the technical aspects, but also some of the organisational aspects. So not just the technical, as an encryption and DRBC and resilience, but looking at things like, well, have we done appropriate due diligence on them? Are staff trained? Have we got role-based access permissions? What can we? How do we access the information? And how do we control access? If there was a subject access request, how do we get the information out of that system? And so on and so forth. to help manage the compliance matters around that. Now, some of this kind of might sound a bit scary, but the law doesn't say you can't share. The law doesn't say you shouldn't use suppliers. We all acknowledge we have to in order to operate, but it's just making sure that we've still got this mind or the this kind of concept or this thought to the fact that I need to make sure we're doing it in a compliant and a managed way. One of the things I tend to come across, as you know, this isn't unusual, is the fact that some people tend to think debt protection is a blocker for things. So if we have to go through all these hoops, it's just going to stop us from doing things. Well, invariably, that's not really the case. Debt protection is actually an enabler. We can enable things to happen. You just need to talk to us early enough, or talk to your representative who's looking after debt protection early enough in order to make sure that the process are going through the compliance is done in a way so you've got the freedoms and you've got the ability to or at least you know the parameters in which you can operate safely and respectfully of the data that you're that you've got access to.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. Just in relation to that comment from Douglas, I've had a chance to read it now, and I completely agree. I think there's a massive issue around fundamentally that statute really being outdated, and I have often thought that it is unfair might not be the right word, but I don't necessarily agree with the idea that charities aren't allowed to rely on the soft opt-in, at least not for their promotion of aims and ideals and fundraising, rather than their actual, if they've got any sort of shops or anything like that.
The soft opt-in's a tricky one. I'm glad it's come up. I know we're kind of slightly over, but it's the soft opt-in's a tricky one because it only relates to products that you've purchased in that sense, of similar products that you purchased. So if you've purchased something from a charity shop, a retail outlet in that kind of sense, a charity shop, does that then by the extension of the soft opt-in means that I can start promoting the aims and ideals, or do I just talk about other items potentially that's available from that shop or from the retail sector in that kind of sense? In addition to that, and I'm not saying you can't use it, I just think if anybody was going to use a soft opt-in, it's awfully difficult to establish. And then secondly, it's awfully difficult to actually manage on a database. If you fundamentally can't manage your database as it is at the moment with the consent mechanisms, understanding your lawful bases, making sure that people aren't putting flags on it inadvertently, so stopping you from using your data, I wouldn't even consider the soft opt-in at this moment in time, because you've got to make sure that your data is right. You've got to know your data. You've got to know your systems, and you've got to know the control measures around it before you even entertain anything about around the soft opt-in. Otherwise, you'll get yourself into trouble.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's, I mean, it's a complex topic.
What we want to do is stick a knife. Yours are...
Michael decided he wanted to jump in there. Apparently, no. But
I got was somebody sticking a knife in something. So I thought, I'm not quite sure who muted it, but it's glad it was muted.
Yeah, it's probably a good
apologies.
Job. That's all right, Michael. Don't worry, it happens. I mean, yeah, it's an incredibly complex topic, and honestly, we could go on all afternoon. There's just some little debate in the chat going on, or maybe not debate, but conversations at least around where consent is needed. And just so that we're clear on this, Dave, consent under PECA is only required for direct marketing emails, right? Everything else, well, and faxes, I guess, but...
A little bit
more
direct.
Who does fax marketing in this day and age?
Well, let's not forget that the consent under PECA is the consent that's now defined in the GDPR. The PECA's the wording of the PECA basically says if we're using undefined terms and the term's defined in data protection law, then you've got to use that term. In essence, so the definition of consent. Isn't you won't find it in PECA, but you will find it in the GDPR, but there's a section in PECA that points to it. So if you are using consent, then it's got to be the GDPR level of consent. And if you're using emails or any kind of tracking cookies and all that kind of peculiar stuff, you will need consent. You don't need consent for telephone communications in that sense, but email, SMS, yes, you do.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to clarify, Michael's having his lunch. He doesn't intend to kill anyone. I thought we'd better get that in the podcast recording, because otherwise we wouldn't want to get him in trouble. Right, well, we've not only run over, we've run over even more than we normally do this week. There's plenty really still to talk about, so if there is appetite for a second session, then please do let me know. We'd love to do another one. It's a topic that we absolutely love talking about. And you know, all the interactions are absolutely not just welcome, but really appreciated.
I couldn't agree more. It's data protection is one of those things that charities need to understand, because they do so much great and valuable work that you, in order to continue with that, you really, and it's kind of my parting shot really, you really need to understand your data. And I mean understand your data, I mean to manage and control it appropriately so you can rely on it, not just from a compliance point of making sure it's accurate and so on, but making sure that we don't have these flags appearing, making sure that people aren't changing bits without any kind of control measures or mechanisms around that, or validity around bits and pieces, because it could hamstring you from trying to do the really valuable work that you're doing. So you do need to know your data, you do need to understand your data and what it's telling, what it's not telling you, what inactivity is not telling, inactivity is telling you. Try to get an understanding and have an organizational stance on what is direct marketing and which bits of the communications that might leave the organization that aren't direct marketing in that sense. And also know your legal bases and how legal bases work, because once you understand the legal bases of how it works, whether that's within PECA or whether that's within the PECA don't have legal bases, it just says you've got to use consent, but understanding PECA, understanding the GDPR, understanding legal bases and getting that understanding, so you've got some kind of framework within your organization where you've got a bit of movement where you can understand and you've got some control measures around that. But it's really key to understanding all of those points.
Absolutely. I was worried then, because you said it was your parting shot, and I've been on phone calls with you before where your parting shot is a full 10 minutes. So I was concerned we were going to be here until tomorrow morning.
I have a big note here saying don't get on your soapbox after last week. So I'm just trying to temper it.
Okay, no worries. Well, nonetheless, thank you for all that, Dave. Thank you for your time. As always, it is very much appreciated. Zam, thank you so much for coming on. It's been great having you. If people have got any questions for you, how can they get in touch with you?
You can my direct number, I can leave you that guy. What I'll do is actually I'll put it on the chat.
Yes.
My email, my direct email and my direct number. So if anyone wants to call me or email me, feel free to reach out. But yeah, it's been an absolute pleasure listening into this. It's been very very entertaining.
Okay, well that's the baseline level that we aim for. So thanks for coming on. Thank you for your time. Much appreciated. Thank you to all those on the session for not just attending, but all your contributions. It's always very much appreciated. We love our little community that we've brought together over these sessions, and we'll always have a great time discussing these topics with you. So we're back again next week, I believe, with one of our sort of open surgery episodes, GDPR Radio, although Miles, correct me if that's not the case, but usually it's alternating weeks. So that should be an episode of GDPR Radio. Same time, same place. If you'd like an invite to that and you haven't got one, then just reach out to us and we'll get that sorted for you. Any other questions, queries, comments, concerns, as I say every time, you can get in touch with us, support@dataprotectionpeople.com, and we'll pick that up. But other than that, thank you so much for attending. And in the meantime, have a lovely weekend. We hope to see you all very soon.
Thank you, everybody. All the best. Have a great weekend. Thank you.